Welcome to Season 8 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the CEO of Harlem Lacrosse, a nonprofit organization which provides academic support, mentorship, and lacrosse programming to students in low-income urban schools in Boston, New York, Philly, Baltimore, and Los Angeles. He attended Brown University, where he was a two-time All-American in lacrosse, before embarking on a professional career in Major League Lacrosse, where he eventually won two championships. He kept busy during his time as a pro off the field as well, though, focusing on helping out those less fortunate, first with Boston-based Metro Lacrosse and later with City Lacrosse in Los Angeles. After eventually hanging up his cleats after a successful seven-year pro career, in 2017, he became the CEO of Harlem Lacrosse, a truly remarkable organization that HPS institutionally and as individuals have been proud to support. I will let this remarkable gent tell the story better than I can, but the difference it has made in kids' lives is profound and sustaining, and he and Harlem Lacrosse are a true inspiration to all of us here at HPS. So without further ado, I am very excited to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Mike Levin, CEO of Harlem Lacrosse. Mike, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mike, I'd like to start from the start. Where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
I'm originally from upstate New York, just outside of Rochester, a town called Pittsford.
All right. So now lacrosse is obviously a through line in your life. Tell me about when and how you started playing.
Yeah, I basically looked up to my older brother who was dabbling in lacrosse. And so I decided that it was something I had to do. So I started in second grade at the town rec center. I played for my town, played for my middle school, I played for my high school. And that was as much as I needed to do to get as good as I could possibly get. It's something that I really cherish.
Okay, Mike. So you end up going to Brown for undergrad. How did you decide that Brown was the right fit for you?
I was a pretty driven student. I wanted to do well in school and I wanted to play lacrosse. And that's like about everything I knew about what I wanted when I was 17. But I think I really valued Brown's perspective on education, the idea of exploring new things and kind of like the de-emphasis, like no core curriculum and kind of take whatever class you want. But I just met a lot of interesting, really smart people who were really different than me from all over the world. And the lacrosse piece was, it kind of like fell into place nicely for me. I really liked the coach who actually left right after I enrolled, basically.
No correlation, Mike, I imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, it does seem like the right blend of athletics and academics. And as you say, the horizon expansion of that sort of how diverse that population is interesting. So you graduate, your talent and your work ethic, it gives you a chance to play post-college in the pros. You're drafted into the Major League Lacrosse League. Tell our listeners what that's like, especially for those internationally who may be less familiar with professional athletics outside of sort of the big four sports leagues here in the States.
Yeah, I mean, it was effectively what you might call like semi-professional. You know, everyone who played had another job. I would say the average salary during the 7 years that I played of all players was probably like $10,000 a year. So it's not your primary income earner, but it was the most competitive lacrosse that existed in the world at the time. So I was really fortunate to play.
Well, Mike, as you said, you know, professional lacrosse is not a full-time career for almost anybody. You ended up moving towards a career in education. Why was education the right path for you?
I think it was like an area of comfort. You know, I was pretty like reflective about teachers and coaches and the impact they could have and had some great relationships. And while I was in college, I started getting interested in urban education reform. And so that kind of led me to really go back to school and be like, hey, I want to get my certification and become a teacher.
So let's talk about that. Tell me about your early experiences. You know, you're in the classroom for the first time. You're a young man. Tell me about what you learned from that experience in the classroom.
Oh, I had an awesome experience. I worked at Quincy High School, huge immigrant population in the community. I taught basically a global studies class, world history class to an ESL class. There were 10 different languages represented in the class. And the host teacher, she sort of like let me do my thing. So I was completely floundering, you know. But it was actually kind of a useful thing as a training educator, I think, because it was like, okay, these kids don't understand what I'm saying. So I have to be incredibly thoughtful about the way in which I'm communicating this idea, you know? And I think had I worked in a different environment, you know, you might fall into the trap of just like, okay, I lecture, I say this stuff, and then the kids know it, and I'm teaching. And that's not teaching. I have to think really creatively about how to do that in a way that it's retained by the students, and then how will I tell if they have actually learned it?
That's the building blocks of how you learn it. So we're up to 2007. You start at Metro Lacrosse in Boston. Tell me about that organization and what specifically you were doing there.
Metro Lacrosse was really about like character development through sport. It was really about, can you learn to be a great teammate, have great work ethic and resilience and sort of interpersonal skills as a result of your participation in sports. So we were trying to like craft a sport experience that would help kids develop those skills.
With a focus on underprivileged youth in Boston? Tell me about it. Yeah.
Same neighborhoods we're in Boston, low-income urban communities. So the organization had been around since 2000. The founder was a guy named Zach Lehman, very dynamic leader. He had gone to Dartmouth and Harvard Law School and then basically started Metro Lacrosse very quickly after Harvard Law School. But he had left, so the organization was dealing with leadership transition. But it had about $1 million budget. I was a program manager, so I was recruiting kids, going into phys ed classes all over Boston, saying, do you want to play lacrosse? And getting them to sign up, and then doing a lot of coaching, trying to institutionalize the program delivery. And I was tutoring kids and helping kids who were applying to high schools.
Okay. So you're at Metro Lacrosse for 7 years or so. You eventually become the CEO in 2012. Talk me through that progression and how your role there evolved over time.
Yeah. So Metro Lacrosse was looking at kind of like a national expansion. So that was kind of like a year-long project that I worked on, which was just thinking about how could we exist with a national footprint. And then I sort of was like, well, if I think I want this to be my career, I should start to think about fundraising a little bit more and what nonprofit management really looks like. I think if I want to do this longer term, that's a skill set that I should explore. So I started to kind of sniff around.
So tell me about that, Mike. I'm always interested in how people learn on the job skills they don't have. You know, to be a successful CEO of a nonprofit is program driven and vision driven, but fundraising obviously is a huge portion of it. How did you learn that? How did you pick up that part of your skill set?
I tried to sort of get exposure to the kinds of things that I didn't know, you know, as I tried to put myself in the position to the best that I could. And I just was sort of like inquisitive, walking around the office, trying to get into meetings that I could get exposure to certain things. And then when I became the executive director, it was completely trial by fire. And I mean, I was completely drinking from a fire hose. And the organization had some like challenges financially. So we were like a bit strapped at the exact moment that I took over. So it was kind of a sink or swim situation, which was...
You figured it out because you had to?
Yeah. It was like, okay, make payroll again. It was like, here's a database of phone numbers. There's a phone. Figure it out. But I've been really fortunate to have some like amazing... Just before this call, I was on with the New Balance Foundation. And I probably have had my first meeting with the New Balance Foundation in like 2008 or 2009. So they've been funding the work that I've been doing for more than 15 years. And we are partners, you know, and that's definitely like informed my perspective on fundraising, that it is a partnership. And in the beginning, I was just sort of hustle and get money and figure it out. But having done it for a little while, it's helped me value that piece of it. That kind of, it's going to be most successful when it is a true partnership.
In 2014, you co-found City Lacrosse in LA with Doc O'Connor, if I have my timing right. Why was that the right time for you to branch out and start something new?
It was personal. My now wife had moved to California, and I had an interest in living here. And Doc emailed me one day. At the time, he was a partner at CAA. In his latter years, like really launching CAA sports. And I got this email saying, hey, I've heard about Metro Lacrosse. I'm kind of interested in that happening in LA. Could I pick your brain? I mean, he was basically like the perfect person to help me. He was someone who loves lacrosse, was hugely generous, and was super well connected in LA. Not long after we started talking, I was sort of like, this could be something we do together. Could you help me get it off the ground? She said yes.
Talk to me about that, getting it off the ground. Building a business from scratch is obviously different than joining an existing organization, no matter how many fires you had to fight. How hard was it to get City Lacrosse going?
It was amazing. I'm so grateful I had the experience of building it from the ground up. I sort of had an eye for the future. I was like, okay, you want to build the donor database in this way. So from the very first donation, try to make sure that your records are accurate and recorded in a certain way, because that will help you do things more efficiently down the road. And whereas if you took over an existing organization and you're sort of like, oh, I want to make some changes, you have to unpack lots of things. So it was super valuable to have that experience, and also really challenging. It was a total like one-man band in the beginning. It was just kind of like, okay, go and get the sticks and then go like write a grant when you get home and then call a bunch of kids to get them there and then order the bus and then, you know, go line the field and then write this curriculum for like our volunteer training later, or go recruit some volunteers. I'm really proud of what we built in the few years there.
Well, and I do think the best senior managers have sort of done every job that they're asking other people to do. And I imagine you learned a ton from that. You know, I'm old enough to think of lacrosse as a Northeast Mid-Atlantic sport, which is, of course, an incredibly dated perspective. But tell me about the lacrosse scene in LA and what it was like.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of places, it tends to be sort of like tight knit. So, you can sort of like roll into town and be like, okay, I'm a lacrosse person. And you kind of like very quickly can meet a few people, but definitely like burgeoning, you know, the other areas of California, San Diego, Orange County and the Bay Area were, I would say, more mature. And LA is kind of like figuring it out. I think LA is struggling, like a lot of places, in a universe in which youth sports is privatized so heavily. How do you build a really broad base of participation? This is what it looks like in a world where, you know, entry level participation is not being driven by like truly recreational programming.
Okay, so after several years of building that, in 2017, you come to New York to become the CEO of Harlem Lacrosse. Let's start with the basics. What was Harlem Lacrosse when you joined 7 years ago?
Yeah, so Harlem, they were about $1 million budget. They had, I think, about 12 or 13 employees. They hired a program director, embedded them in a school. They're going to provide academic support and guidance during the school day, and then run study hall and lacrosse programming during the out-of-school time hours.
And Mike, let me interrupt there. Explain exactly how the programs work, because I think it's a really interesting model. If you are a student who's going to participate in Harlem Lacrosse, how does your life get impacted?
Yes. So a program director will be in your school and they will make a presentation in your class, or they will find you in the lunchroom or before school or after school. A great program director will find out who are kids that they think could benefit from this program, talk to teachers about kids that are struggling, and they'll say, hey, come play lacrosse. This is what Harlem Lacrosse is all about. And so you'll start going to practices. And then that person is going to start to provide academic counseling for you. They're going to find out how you're doing in school and be like, okay, I know that you're struggling in math class. I'm going to come to your math class third period, or I'm going to make sure I connect you with a tutor after school because I think you have this big assignment coming up, or I know you have this test coming up. Their job is to be essentially an academic coach.
So give our listeners then a sense of the scale today. How many kids are involved? Like, what do outcomes look like? How does this all work now, Mike?
Yeah, so it's about 1,200 kids a year annually. They do, on average, last year, 229 hours of attendance per year. So we definitely like view depth over breadth. You know, we're trying to serve kids for as many hours a year as possible, or for the optimal amount of time, as opposed to serve as many kids as possible. They're in five cities. There's 41 people who have the job of program director. There are 61 staff members. The budget's $8.2 million. In terms of outcomes, we're really focused on long-term academic trajectory. Are you matriculating on time to the next grade? Are you graduating high school? Are you matriculating to college? Are you persisting in college? Our cohorts are getting larger. The 2026s, the current freshmen, we think they could be about 150 when they're seniors.
Could you share any success stories or memorable moments for your time?
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about some of the early cohorts, there's a student, she was an amazing kid, and I don't think anyone in her family envisioned her playing lacrosse, you know? And she had a great few years playing lacrosse. She went on and didn't play lacrosse in high school, but kind of maintained a connection to the program. I saw her last year. She worked our overnight camp. We helped her in the college process a little bit. She goes to Berkeley. Now she's participating in our internship program. So she's going back for a second year at Cisco. And I think she's got a great shot at getting like a full-time offer when she graduates. I hope that she feels that she can do whatever she wants to, and that the world will be open to her. So that's one that kind of stands out, I think, is sort of emblematic of what we want to happen. It's also indicative of sort of like lacrosse not being elemental to the whole thing. Sort of like, it's not that we're trying to make every kid into a great lacrosse player.
You just mentioned the internships. We hadn't touched on that part. Can you just expand on that a little bit about how that works for the, you know, for the kids as they grow up?
Yeah, it's something that's evolved a bit organically, you know, where we have really deep relationships with students and families. It's like a hallmark of Harlem Lacrosse. We see them a lot. We do a lot of overnight travel. We support a lot of independent school applications. There's about 90 kids a year that are at a boarding school somewhere now. And we are pretty involved in the college application process. So we have these like deep relationships. And we have a great set of corporate partners as well. So we sort of like simultaneously have these group of kids aging up through college who are amazing kids. And I would say like we have more and more corporations that are thinking more deeply about the diversity of their talent pipeline. So they're sort of like, hey, we want to diversify the people who work here. And it's a hard thing to change overnight. So we really think that we need to start upstream and try and bring in more diverse people into this organization from an early age. And so we sort of like found ourselves in this position of saying, well, I know a lot of great kids who are from Harlem. They've grown up as student athletes. You know, they're really hardworking. They're great teammates. They have all the skills of the people that are doing really well at your institution now. We started sort of connecting the dots a little bit first one by one. And now it's becoming a bit more systematic. We'll probably place 40 to 50 kids this year. Maybe 10 to 12 firms are participating. The primary function we're playing is really that matchmaker function. And we're looking at other areas of programming there, just like the cohort model type stuff where kids can connect with each other, saying, hey, what are you experiencing at your internship? Like, what kinds of things have worked well for you? Some kids are doing amazingly well, and then kind of sharing their experience with the next cohort who might be applying. So that's what it looks like today.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I'll say as a public service announcement, you know, we at HPS have had interns the last couple of years. We're going to welcome some more this summer. If your institution, whoever's listening to this, is looking for, they're incredible. Like, it's your point. What I love about Harlem Lacrosse is that lacrosse is part but not all of this. You've got kids who are good kids, who work hard and, you know, want to do well. They have the structure and support of being team athletes, which I think is great, period. But they're much more than that. And I think it's fantastic what you guys have been able to do. Mike, what's next for Harlem Lacrosse? What are you most excited about in the coming years?
You know, we are currently in the process of writing our next strategic plan. And I would say, like, I have a lot of faith that Harlem Lacrosse will exist at a larger size. You know, that if we can really execute well as a development office, there are amazing people and institutions in the world who believe in the work that we're doing. And I think we can collectively like generate a lot of resources to do good in the world. What we look like at a larger size could be a few things. I think like more robust services for older students as kids age up through is something that we really want to invest deeply in. We don't want to take our eye off the ball there. I wouldn't say that like a new region is necessarily like right on the table right now, but I think in the next 3 to 5 years, that's something we would be looking at for sure. One of the things that I hope we can offer is sort of the idea of Harlem Lacrosse. It's kind of an old school idea. It's kind of like a very traditional teacher coach model. So we're just kind of like applying it to a different setting, but I think it could be much larger. You know, like the implication of that is that if you make this type of investment, you can really like advance educational equity. There's school systems all over the country that are not producing the outcomes that they want or that we want or that the kids and the families in those communities deserve. That's not because there aren't smart, hardworking people trying to do that. How can we get the most out of the school system so that the outcomes that are possible for the students with the most resources are possible for every student in this country? And I hope that that's part of our impact or legacy.
It's very exciting. What you're doing now is incredible, we think, and we're excited to see what you're up to next. So, Mike, listen, you're doing great things helping students succeed. And for that, we applaud you. We appreciate your thoughts and insights. With that, I want to move to the last segment of the podcast, something we like to call Best Ideas. That's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently, Best Ideas, because it's our goal as investor to maximize exposure to those. Mike, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
Yeah, I hope it's not too like cliche, but I think like a little meditation to start the day, something has really like affected me and a lot, you know, as the organization has gotten larger, there's more things to worry about. And I think being able to put yourself in for the person who's in my role, kind of the right like mindset can really like maximize your productivity. But it's just, it took me a long time to figure out what I needed to do that. For a long time, I had my head down and just kind of trying to do as much as you possibly can at every given time. It took me getting to the point where like, okay, I don't think I can do all the things that I need to do. Say, okay, I need to like figure out a way to get more out of each hour. And someone gave me that recommendation. It has been really positive. That's what I'll share as my best idea.
I don't think it's cliche at all, Mike. I think we reflexively reach for our phone the first thing in the morning, and that time to take a breath and say, let's, you know, see the forest for the trees. It's crucial for anybody, but especially a leader of an organization. I think it really matters. So yeah, I think that is in fact the best idea. Well, for mine then, Mike, as listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guests of the week. And I do have a normal best idea this week, but before I get there, if you have also felt inspired by Mike today, as we at HPS are every time we interact with Harlem Lacrosse, please go to their website, make a contribution. They are making a difference and it is money well spent. So that's my real best idea. But as for regular programming, as you heard earlier, Mike went to Brown University in the city of Providence, Rhode Island. I host a podcast, but I also listen to them constantly. It's like what I do on my commute into and from the office. And so thinking about Providence, I immediately came to one of my favorite podcasts of all time. My best idea recommendation this week actually goes back a couple of years to a truly remarkable podcast called Crime Town. season one specifically, which is called Divine Providence, which is all about the rise and fall of the Providence mayor, Buddy Cianci. So first off, true crime podcasts are all the rage these days, but this is like a trailblazer. It came out 7 years ago now. And it follows the story of Buddy Cianci. He was the mayor twice of Providence, amazingly both terms ending due to his criminal activities. If you wrote the Cianci story as a movie, the Hollywood studio would quietly give you a note that no one's going to believe this. A mayor who ran against corruption, who tortured a man he thought was having an affair with his wife. He was deeply in bed with the Providence mob. I mean, the story plays out like a novel, but it's all 100% true. And for those not familiar, it's a fascinating insight into how the line between politics and organized crime at the local level can get awfully murky. So, in honor of Mike, one of Providence's good guys, I want to be clear, let me recommend a truly wild podcast about things can go very, very wrong in that town, the podcast Crime Town, Season 1, available on all streaming platforms. Mike, any thoughts on Buddy Cianci?
Oh, man, amazing podcast. Also recommend the book, The Prince of Providence, about the same topic. I think that he may have been the mayor when I first got to school, but I might be wrong about that. But just an amazing story, really. It's
wild.
Very entertaining.
It's totally wild. And you'll get to an end of the podcast and be like, well, they must have sensationalized that. And then you'll read the article about it. You're like, nope, that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's wild. So anyway, a good one and a fascinating listen. With that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Mike, sincerely appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. Always great to catch up and good luck with continuing with Harlem Lacrosse's success.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to HPS for the partnership.
Thanks again to our guest, Mike Leonard. Check out our show notes to learn more about Mike and his role at Harlem Lacrosse. You'll also find a link to my best idea of the week, season one of the podcast, Crime Town. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.